Sometimes you have to learn how not to use technology. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
And as always, it's great to be back recording a live program and not doing a rerun or a something we threw together on the fly. It's nice to have our schedules kind of mesh for once.
It is very much so. Well, Chuck, since we've last sat in the studio together, there have been a number of major things that have been happening in the world and in the state of Ohio, and I think we're going to spend some time today talking about a few of them, probably some of the ones that are more out there and obvious. We're going to be talking at the national level about some technology issues, and we're going to be talking at the state level on some issues that are related, and then we're just going to be chatting up about why it's important that we, that is not just you and me, but the body of believers, start understanding how to put pieces together to come up with the accurate picture of what's going on out there. But first, I think that, number one, we deserve to give our listeners, they deserve for us to give them a update and report on the RUC banquet that just happened.
Well, that's right.
We've been advertising.
We've been advertising the Relationships Under Construction banquet. It was Thursday, March the 5th. It was a very good and a very informative banquet. And if you came as a result of listening to us on here on WLRY, well, thank you very much. You heard a good speaker, a great speaker in Jeffrey Dean. You got a chance to meet Bob Burney from a rival radio station. You got to meet Jerry Revish, who's a newscaster on Channel 10 in Columbus. You basically got a chance to come and meet Chuck and Barry, which unfortunately you didn't do. So,
well, and you also got to see Chuck in his stage debut.
That's right. That's right.
as he performed an impromptu act.
That's right. I was so, part of the entertainment.
So impromptu that until I mentioned something to him a day or two before the event, he didn't realize he was going to be doing. So,
yes. Yeah, so my big laugh getter of the night was completely ad-libbed.
Absolutely. But actually, they get quite a few laughs. Now, some of the things that didn't get laughs the other night, Charles, was when we showed some of the clips of videos that are being shown in many of our classrooms by Planned Parenthood. Now, I, you know what, Chuck? I'm an old salt. I'm a little jaded. I used to work for an organization that fought pornography and sex businesses and all that other good stuff, or bad stuff, as the case may be. And I thought I was pretty much, you know, immune to being shocked. Not so much. That first video that was offered was, it had a gotcha in it, and the gotcha was pretty disgusting.
Yeah, and we can't even describe it. So, unfortunately, here's the bad part, Barry.
These are things they're showing to our kids.
Not only that, they're available both on the Planned Parenthood website and on YouTube.
Oh, lovely.
So if you really want to see what we showed, and this is the reason why we put the caveat, I think, a couple weeks ago that it's not for the kids. Because we do show you what is being done in the name of education by Planned Parenthood and why we are the only real in Relationships Under Construction, the real alternative. I'm not easily shocked, and I got to tell you, I was a little shocked. It takes a lot to my skin's really thick, and I know yours is too.
Yes.
One of those was exceedingly shocking. The other one was also shocking. And in fact, it was subtle enough, though, that there were people I know in the audience who didn't understand what was going on.
Or what was wrong.
Yeah. And again, we can't describe it, but I can tell you that's how subtle this stuff can be. All I can say about the guy who was the host, you know, who was the spokesman in both videos.
Oh, for the Planned Parenthood videos, yeah. Yes.
Wow. Talk about your greasy uncle that nobody wants to see at a family reunion.
And I think everybody understands what you're talking about. Yeah. There, yes.
Yeah. So it wasn't all fun and games. There was some serious stuff there, and it was there to... for the specific purpose of showing you what is going on, because you need to know, because your kids aren't going to run home and say, hey, guess what I saw in health today? They're not going to tell you that. First of all, because it's embarrassing. Second of all, because they're told in class, do not go home and tell your parents what you're seeing here.
Right, exactly. And again, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, if you all want to go out and look at stuff up, but this is the second time that we've had clips from Planned Parenthood supported or funded classroom instructional materials that we've been able to show people, including some of our state legislators who were in attendance that night. What, when they send tax dollars to these quote-unquote reproductive health organizations, what they're actually getting.
Right.
What they're getting is celebration and advancement of perversions, of homosexual lifestyles, of self-abuse, and of an egalitarian philosophy that basically says that, well, you can make up your own mind and do whatever you feel like as long as you enjoy it and anybody else who you're with enjoys it.
Well, it's even pseudo-egalitarian, because if you think about it, who are this is everybody's equal except the pigs.
Yes.
If you've read Animal Farm. Animal Farm,
yes.
Animal Farm, when the rules come out and they print it out and all the animals start reading the rules, and it had originally been everyone is equal, and it became everyone is equal except the pigs. Well, when these reproductive rights groups, quote-unquote reproductive rights, who are everyone else? Who are the pigs and who are everyone else? Well, the born are the pigs, and the unborn are those who aren't as equal as the pigs.
Right.
So, as always in an egalitarian society, there really are only two classes. You know, they tell you we're a single class. No, there are those in charge and those who are slaves. And you may do with a slave what you will, and the unborn are the slaves. Right. Yes, we're not engaging their labor, but we are taking them apart, and we are coming up with schemes to use the spare parts.
Yes, and it's interesting that you bring that particular issue up, because another thing that happened this week, Charles, at the state level, was that the House Community and Family Advancement Committee held a hearing on House Bill 69, which is Ohio's Human Heartbeat Protection Amendment, or as they've renamed it, the Dr. Jack Wilkie Human Heartbeat Protection Amendment, in honor of the recently deceased founder of the national and international pro-life movement, Dr. Jack Wilkie, who passed away
about two weeks ago.
After an extended period of illness. But there were 32 people, Chuck, who signed up to testify, about 8 or 9, maybe 10 opponent groups, which included your usual suspects yeah. of the ACLU and Planned Parenthood and NARAL and the League of Women Voters and the American Association of University Women and Professors, all of the hardcore feminist, leftist, progressivist groups who see abortion as a sacrament for them. Now, the problem was they were completely outnumbered by families of children who they would like to see aborted because they had certain fetal abnormalities or Down syndrome or didn't think that they would be able to live, including a young child who actually was diagnosed with trisomy 18 and whose parents chose not to get pressured by the hospital to abort. That child is now 3 months old and seems to be rebounding and starting to thrive.
That's the problem with some of the trisomies. There are differing degrees of gene expression. And what we mean by trisomy, as you may or may not be aware, you get 23 pairs equals 46 chromosomes. Well, on some of the pairs, there are mistakes. And so you get three, you get a triplet instead of a pair. So what happens is you get an extra set of genes. And depending on how that extra set gets expressed, because genetics isn't everything, genetics expression is a big part of the picture. This is why, even though Barry and I both have the gene for melanin in our skin,
yes,
both of us would be considered Caucasian because we don't express that gene very heavily.
Right.
We have friends who are darker skinned.
Right.
And that's a continuum. There is dark all the way down to the blackest black you can imagine. I have had, when I worked in college, I worked with some guys that were from Central Africa.
Yes.
And those are the blackest black men I ever saw. They are black.
Yeah, and the palest Caucasian you ever see are people from Ireland mainly.
Well, my
or
wife,
Norway, my, or other places.
My wife and daughters are very pale. Although I have seen even paler people. We're not talking albino.
No,
we're talking very little melanin. So that's what we mean by gene expression. We all have these genes. We just don't express them the same.
That's right. That's right. So we had that. We also had medical doctors. We had pro-life leaders. We had numerous people testify. Now, this testimony went on into the late evening. There will be another hearing on the bill, most likely for a vote. The bill has 50 co-sponsors in the House, and the vast majority of people on the Community and Family Advancement Committee are co-sponsors of the bill, including one of the Democrat members, Representative Bill Patman from Cleveland, who understands the idea of the continuum of life and is very pro-life himself, and so therefore has stepped out of line of his party's platform, where abortion is a right in his party's platform, to support a pro-life measure, at the consternation of, I think, both of his party and of the Planned Parenthood and NARAL cabals, who like to think that everybody should walk in lockstep with them in the Democratic Party.
Right.
So basically, we see this bill. It's going to come out of committee. High likelihood it's coming out of committee. We have 50 co-sponsors, which means we have enough votes for the floor of the House. And again, the situation is going to be, what will Senate President Keith Faber and Senate leadership do when the bill comes over to the Senate for hearings? As we know in the past, a last session, they completely gummed up the works by working in cohort with the House Speaker to keep the bill from even getting a hearing in the House until the very last days of the session so that they wouldn't have to deal with it. And in the previous session before that, when the House passed the bill overwhelmingly, they then bottled it up and killed it in order to keep it from moving forward, with then-Senate President Tom Niehaus actually pulling it from committee the day it was supposed to be voted out of committee and burying it in his Rules Committee and then not letting it see the light of day. Again, Chuck, there have been numerous attempts to try to kill this bill. And honestly, you would think, and this thought occurred to me the other day, if these members and these leaders believe this bill to be unconstitutional, go ahead and let it go through and let the courts kill it.
Yeah.
Be done with it. That way you can say, we passed it, although we didn't believe it to be constitutional. Do a George Bush. With the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform, George Bush said, I believe this law is unconstitutional, but I'm going to sign it into law anyway and let the courts decide. Guess what happened?
Yeah.
Courts didn't go the same way they thought they were going to go, and they found it to be constitutional. Chuck, we have it under some very good legal authority that the court, once invited to look at things in a different light, oftentimes have moved and changed. I mean, we saw it with Roe v. Wade. Then we went to Planned Parenthood versus Casey later on. Yes, that established some more freedoms for abortion, but it also established some more restrictions. the Carhartt decision also did the same thing. That's where we got a piece out of the decision that said that, hey, if you can show that this, that there is an unalienable sign of life, then we have to come back and think about this again. A heartbeat is one of the undeniable basic signs of human life.
And it shows up way early.
And it shows up very early. Yeah. So we're somewhat cautiously optimistic that the bill will be moved from committee, that the House floor, it will be moved from the House floor. And then we'll have to spend quite a bit of time convincing our senators that, okay, if you really just don't think this bill's very good, you pass a lot of bills that aren't very good, and you passed a number of bills that are later found to be unconstitutional. How about you just go ahead and just let this thing go through and be done with it?
Uh-huh.
And then let the pro-life community and our attorneys and the courts work this out. That's really all it gets down to. They're worried because, well, you know, we can't pass. Well, you know what? Most people don't understand most of the legislation that's passed in the General Assembly or in Congress anyway, and most of what's passed in Congress is unconstitutional because there's no warrant for it. But the state has a warrant under the 10th Amendment that if it's not specifically enumerated to the federal Congress, they have the authority over it. These issues are things that the states can pass regardless of what the Supreme Court has said in the past, because being a human institution, the Supreme Court has this tendency to change its mind.
Oh,
because if the Supreme Court if the Supreme Court would not have changed its mind, African Americans would still be held in voluntary servitude because of a little decision that everybody knows about, that we all point back to. It's the Jim Crow laws. Plessy versus Ferguson.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So you have these cases where even the Supreme Court has said this isn't settled in our minds. And there have been invitations on the issues of life and the beginning of life where the courts over time have said this issue isn't totally settled in our minds.
Well, if you recall the original Roe v. Wade decision, one of the decisions, and I'm trying to remember which Supreme Court justice made this statement, but what he said was, well, we don't know when life begins, but we're going to err on this side, on the side of basically birth.
Right.
Until such time as proof emerges of some other point in other words, he left the door open for a new decision. Now, unfortunately, he clearly was not familiar with biology, because biology makes it clear that a separate and distinct human being exists from the moment of conception, because there is half a set of chromosomes from one side, from the mother, and half a set from the father that combine to make this new individual. And you may have heard the term recombinant DNA. What happens when those two seeds come together is that the DNAs actually swap sections. Part of the DNA from the mother goes over to the father's part, and part of the father's goes to the mother, and they actually recombine. And that's why you get such an interesting new little individual.
That's right.
And that person is conceived as a separate individual. You can make the argument that, yes, a lot of babies at that point spontaneously abort. Okay, fine. That's true. And you know why that happens usually? Because that individual is so damaged that it cannot survive.
Right, exactly.
So nature's way of dealing with that is to abort that fetus on its own. And that's why you get miscarriages very early. My wife and I had one of those really early. Why? We don't know. Probably a very damaged infant. Okay. Yeah. That being said, the Supreme Court has the door open if any of them want to familiarize themselves with that decision, because that's where it was left. We're not smart enough to realize when life begins. Well, yes, we are.
Well, we're starting to get more and more so, and that kind of gets right into our theme that we're talking about today, Chuck, because what's happened since Roe v. Wade in 1973 is that technology has become better.
Oh, very advanced.
And our ability to pinpoint and even photograph the beginnings of life and the development in the womb has become so much greater. We have 3D ultrasounds now. Those ultrasound wasn't even a fully functional category back in 1973. Now we have Doppler ultrasounds. We have 3D ultrasounds. We have numerous tests for everything under the sun. The technology now has created a situation where we have to apply that new knowledge back to the court. You see, there's my fundamental frustration with not only the left, but also some of our more, shall we say, unthinking friends in legislature on the right who are all worried about constitutionality. Folks, we are dealing in an entirely different environment than the original 1973 Roe versus Wade.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's just on the technology aspects alone. Exactly.
DNA technology was less than 30 years old in 1973.
Right.
Now it's over 60.
Oh, and it's over 70, actually. Yeah. It's huge. And the point is, it's becoming, okay, I know that we probably or some of our listeners are big fans of the cop, like CSI and all these other ones. Folks, all of that stuff that they can do when they can pull a strand of hair and tell you what the guy had for breakfast 3 weeks ago is things that we are doing right now in science, especially around the unborn child.
And those advances have mostly been made since 2000.
Absolutely. Chuck, we've got situations now, and I mean, this was happening back in the 90s, where they were actually performing surgeries on the unborn child in the womb.
Yes.
Anybody remember Samuel Armus, the baby who, the famous picture of the little hand reaching up and grasping
his pinky.
The doctor's pinky.
Yeah.
Because he was performing a surgery on that unborn child in the womb. Now we're to the point where doctors can work on children as young as when they have a detectable heartbeat. Now, if a doctor can use their medical skills to try to save a 6-week-old infant, why shouldn't we make sure that we don't allow them to use those same medical skills to murder a 6-week-old infant?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I want to invite the court to come into the 21st century because we're dealing with 19th century thinking in Roe versus Wade. You know, and of course, Planned Parenthood and NARAL continue to push that meme when they start talking about coat hangers and back alley abortions. Folks, we're in the 21st century. The only reason those type of things happen is because people have been led to believe that those are their only options.
Right.
Now, the problem for Planned Parenthood and NARAL is part of the heartbeat bill isn't just banning an abortion, it's promoting adoption. And I'm actually trying to work with some of the members. One member who wanted to bring in an amendment on keeping rape and incest in the bill, you know, putting rape and incest exceptions in the bill. I'm trying to work with them to go the other direction and say, no. Let's use the Adoption Commission and let's funnel more resources to those. If we have a young woman who has had a conception due to one of those violent crimes, that we come alongside of her with support and we provide material support for the woman, and we also provide a reduction in red tape and roadblocks for adoptive families who commit early on to adopt that child.
Yeah, but here's the problem, Barry, the way I see it. Legislators who want to continue to work on that basically failed meme of the idea of rape and incest exceptions are still forgetting the idea that it's not the mother whose decision it is. That decision is supposed to be in the hands of God. In other words, that individual that is created by conception has the right to live. And that right to life outweighs the mother's right to be free of a memory of the horrible thing that has happened to her. Or the bad or illegal thing in the case of incest.
Right.
in a case of a rape, yes, it's awful, and I'm very sorry for the woman. But that doesn't mean you don't get to apply the death penalty to one of the victims.
Exactly. And at least two of the people who testified this week on the bill were ladies whose mothers they were conceived in rape. In other words, their mothers chose not to abort them, even though they were conceived as a result of a violent crime. They're giving startlingly brilliant testimony on the fact that every life is precious, and it doesn't matter the consequences of your conception. The point is, you're not responsible for it, so that's why right. should you pay the penalty? Folks, and that's really what it gets down to. We can either be humanitarian and compassionate, or we can be barbarian and callous. And if we decide that we the living, i.e. the ones who are up walking on two legs, get to determine which of the unborn, the defenseless unborn, live and die, we're no better off than the Roman Empire, who, because they didn't feel that a child was going to be a asset to the state, had them thrown out under the overpasses and the bridges to die in the elements.
Yeah, they put them in basically, instead of doing abortions, which at the time you could do a chemical abortion, quote unquote chemical abortion. There are any number of herbs that will induce abortion,
right?
And I'm not going to mention what they are.
No,
some of them commonly available. What they would do generally is go to birth, and then leave the child out in the garbage dump.
Right.
And what people don't realize is that one of the things that grew the ranks of Christianity so fast in the first and second centuries was the fact that the Christians would comb the garbage dumps and take the children home and raise them as their own.
Exactly.
So that's how the Roman Empire essentially went from the cult of death, which is what we are slipping into, is the cult of death, because the idea that somehow we have control over life. Yes, we can take our own lives. We can take someone else's life. That puts us in the realm of the culture of death, because our idea should be to protect life as much as possible. And we're not talking about, let's separate out the idea. There's kind of a strange idea that means that we also save people who have taken others' lives. Somehow life in prison is a better punishment for those people than the death penalty. No, it's not. You are sending them to immediate judgment. That's why you do the death penalty. The death penalty is prescribed by God so that they may go and be immediately judged by God.
Right.
Does that mean we don't try to evangelize those individuals and have them accept Christ before they go? No. And hopefully they do. But just because you're forgiven, I can forgive you of assaulting me, but that doesn't mean you don't have to pay the price for right. having done so.
Right.
And that's the bottom line. So it's an apples and oranges comparison.
That's true. So we're hoping that this bill passes so that we can move forward and we can help show the courts that technology is not something to be afraid of.
Right.
And that technology actually is showing that we can be humanitarian. And in the words of Jack Wilkie, love them both. We can love both the mother and the child, regardless of the circumstances, and bring them both to a healthy future.
It's interesting you say that, talk about technology, because I have recently seen... and I can't remember, the details kind of escaped me, but someone came out and said it was a bad idea to use ultrasound for quote-unquote taking keepsake photos.
Sure.
And the thing that immediately came to mind was, oh, yeah, somebody doesn't like those 3D pictures because they actually show it's no longer kind of a nebulous little cloudy outline that moves around on it. Now it's a 3D, three-dimensional. It's a little round baby with a round head and little legs that are chubby and little hands and feet and the whole thing. I mean, you can get some serious facial detail on those things.
Yes, you can.
The more, the better the technology becomes, the more it becomes clear without getting in there. You're getting very close to getting a picture.
Yes, you are.
And can see that they look like mom or look like dad or look like grandpa or grandma. And the more that happens, the more of an it becomes obvious that's an individual. And that's really bad for the current state of groups like Planned Parenthood, ACLU.
So in other words, the left has a technology problem now.
Yes, they do.
Right. Well, Chuck, that kind of goes right into our next point that we're going to talk about in this theme. Because, yes, the left does have a technology problem. For those who've been paying any attention or watching any of the news channels or listening to news talk radio, you know that there's this little thing going on right now around a presumptive 2016 presidential candidate. I almost said nominee because it's almost like that the party hasn't already nominated the potential candidate Hillary Clinton. And a question about her technological habits. And Chuck, you know, you're more the tech guru. In other words, folks, you wouldn't be hearing our program if it wasn't for Chuck knowing technology and knowing how to put this all together to get a recording over to the radio station. What is the problem here with Hillary and her technology? Because it would seem from first blush that she's just like everybody else. She just has trouble figuring out how to use a computer correctly.
Well, if that were only the problem. The problem is that Miss Hillary, in order to keep her emails, her government service emails, as inaccessible as possible.
Oh, and let's also remember that her government service was not as First Lady.
No.
But as the Secretary of State of the United States.
Secretary of State. In other words, her job... Let's talk about this. Her job was to deal with all the foreign relations for the federal government, for the executive branch.
For the Obama administration.
For the Obama administration.
That's right. Let's keep that in mind, too.
So in order to keep her emails private, because as we know, Hillary is really familiar with trying to hide documents. Let's not kid ourselves. She has become a master of it.
Whitewater, ring a bell?
Whitewater... There's all kinds of stuff. The cattle futures.
Yes.
If you remember, those of us who are old enough to remember, for you youngsters out there, Hillary may turned, $4 into $100,000 or something, you know, really absurd in running cattle futures. People don't make that kind of money selling cattle futures and dealing in cattle futures unless they have a lot of insider information. And she spent a good part of the 90s and part of the 2000s hiding her paper trail on things that could have really damaged Bill Clinton and herself. Bill Clinton as president, herself as a potential future presidential candidate. Now, 20 years later, here we go again. And Hillary basically set up an email server and only used that, a privately owned email server with a private domain name for government business. Well, there are all kinds of problems with this, Barry.
Yes,
I mean, all kinds of problems. First of all, it was a way to get out from under congressional oversight.
True.
It was also a security nightmare.
Right.
Because all email, somebody can hack it. The more complex the security gets, the more complex the hackers get. Let's not kid ourselves. However, it gets harder and harder and harder and harder. Not when you got a little private email server stuck off someplace. Now, what that means is that all the emails that she sent back and forth to the president, now all of a sudden the president's sort of like, well, we don't know if we got any emails from the... First, they denied that they'd ever gotten an email from the Secretary of State.
Yes, but if she was using a private email, then maybe they didn't get it from the Secretary of State. They got it from Hillary Clinton.
Well, no, they wouldn't have gotten it from Hillary Clinton because she used a fake name.
She used an alias. That's yeah. Right. She used an alias, which leads even more problems.
Yes,
you
exactly.
Know, of, okay, How would anybody on the receiving end, especially if any of these emails were sent to officials in foreign countries, number one, know that they were actually dealing with the Secretary of State of the United States, or two, weren't potentially seeding things
yeah.
in order to have their decisions or their thoughts kept private by the Secretary of State? There's so many potential violations of federal
right.
law and federal regulations about what Hillary has done with this. Now, Chuck, I found it interesting because looking at this, you know, because of course it came up and Trey Gowdy, who's a congressman who is on the is head of the House committee investigating Benghazi,
right,
which Hillary was also involved in, and these emails seem to be kind of connected to in some way, said that, you know what, there's no way for the State Department to know it's acquired all the documents that should be made public around this. So he's questioning her private email. Now, you know, of course, what happened was she said, well, I've complied with everything the State Department has, and we released all of the official documents. Well, and that she had the right to keep everything else private, and they've locked her server down so nobody else can get into it. And she said she has that right because the server was on her private property.
Oops.
Well, that's an oops we're going to come back to in just a minute. But the bigger oops, Chuck, is Hillary Clinton is showing that she is just another bureaucrat. Okay? Because in looking at the emails that were on this server, her office indicated specifically that she chose not to keep thousands of private personal emails that were, quote, not federal records. Her office said that included 31,830 emails. Okay? The only problem is they turned over 30,490 work-related emails. Hillary's doing more personal on this server than
yeah.
she's doing, than she's doing official work for the State Department. That sounds like an awful lot of bureaucrats in offices now when they get caught busting surfing for porn. You know, they're not doing the people's work. They're doing their own private work, which leads to another issue. Was Hillary using this to hand out insider information on things that were about to happen to people who could stand
yeah.
to make lots of money from it and then turn around and give to her presidential campaign?
Well, they went from broke to having basically
millions.
Tens of millions of dollars in assets. So there, you know, there's something funky there. And I think that is a real question. There's another issue here, Barry. Well, I threw away 32,000 personal emails.
Right.
How do we know they're personal without oversight?
Well, because we have to trust Hillary.
There's one reason why you're basically required. When you're sitting in an office like that, you are required to use the government email servers.
Right, exactly.
Did she violate the law? Probably she did.
Absolutely.
And a serious law, because when you're Secretary of State, you cannot take the chance and keep your communications away from government oversight.
Right.
Now,
that's the reason why these committees are set up, is to
that's
make
right.
as a check and balance on the executive branch becoming too powerful because they don't have transparency.
And that's why you have to have certain clearances to serve on, for instance, the Intelligence Committee. You can't. Joe Schmo can't serve on it. You have to go through an FBI background check to serve on the Intelligence Committee. The reason she can say I threw away 32,000 personal emails. How do we know they were personal?
Because she told us.
There are emails
about Chelsea's wedding and yoga routines and recipes and what she likes on Pinterest. You know, those are the emails she supposedly threw away.
And unfortunately, Barry, what that does is it sets up a circular reasoning.
Yes, it does.
Because okay, if you had a track record
mm-hmm.
of never lying,
right,
always telling the truth,
right,
always being open.
Yes, indeed.
You could say, okay, maybe.
Okay, great. Well, then I guess we can give Hillary Clinton a pass then, because she meets all of this with flight. Wait,
oops.
No. Let me go in the Wayback Machine. Okay, here we are during the Watergate hearings.
Yes, the Watergate hearings.
Where Hillary Clinton was a young attorney who was connected to the House committee that was looking to impeach President Richard Nixon over the fact that he couldn't produce 9 minutes of audio tape.
I think it was 18, but nonetheless.
Well, it was 9 minutes that they were very concerned about. It was 18, yeah. Everybody knows about 18 minutes of tape, but it was 9 minutes. What people don't realize is that that young attorney, Hillary Clinton, was fired from the committee due to ethical lapses and possibly criminal behavior in manufacturing certain things.
Yes.
And hiding certain other things. Well, okay, so check that first one off the list, okay? But then we roll up and, you know, and she learned her lesson over time. And, you know, she became, that was a young 20-something impressionable kid. So she was older, more mature. She got married. She settled down. And her husband became president of the United States. And she was a pillar of the nation at that point. Whitewater. Vince Foster.
Yeah.
Cattle Futures, Fort Marcy Park. Wait a minute. I'm starting to see a pattern starting to form here, Charles. If I remember correctly, the emails and the documents around all of those issues seem to have vanished into thin air as well.
Amazing.
But wait. You know, it was the pressure of being the first lady and being the president. And so we roll forward a few years, and, you know, she's learned better and she's learned her lesson. And now she's been elevated. She ran for president against Barack Obama, but she lost. And in an effort of conciliation among the Democratic Party, Barack Obama appoints her Secretary of State, and she flubs Benghazi and then tries to obfuscate it and say it really doesn't matter.
Well, if you recall, she sent, we don't know for sure that she sent somebody, but a henchman went into the National Archives
and removed some documents.
Stuffed a bunch of documents in his pants. Who was that? Gosh, Barry. It's embarrassing. It's a big name. It was a guy who was a journalist, if I remember right, and he wanted to cover up some of the stuff. He didn't want it in the National. And guess what? Those papers have never been recovered.
No. It wasn't a reporter. It was Sandy Berger.
Sandy Berger.
Who was
National Security Advisor. Yeah.
That's right. National Security Advisor, who went into there and removed classified documents and personal notes from the National Archives back in 2003. During preparation for his appearance before the 9/11 commission.
Yeah, and I don't believe those documents were ever recovered.
No, they were not.
Which means they met the shredder.
They were destroyed. Yeah. And it's interesting that Berger goes in there and specifically put them in his portfolio and in his jacket and pants pockets and other places. He was taking anything he thought was incriminating and destroying the originals so that it couldn't be found again. But yeah, that was Sandy Berger, who worked for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Billary
Clinton, that's right. So, Chuck, there is, if you want to look at a track record, the trend line is indicating that 31,830 emails weren't all just yoga exercises and wedding plans. There might have been numerous plans about supporting regimes that are hostile to the United States. There could be emails about fomenting insurrections and maybe even domestically involving themselves in certain things.
Aiding and abetting Muslim Brotherhood. Because as I recall early on in this thing, we were like all for that. As a matter of Obama foreign policy, and Hillary Clinton was a big part of that. So the fact is that there's some incriminating emails. For instance, it's come to light that Hillary Clinton knew the night that the ambassador was killed
at Benghazi,
In Benghazi, that she knew it was not a popular uprising, that it was, in fact, an attack, a coordinated attack, and which she denied under oath.
Yes, under oath.
And that's exactly what I've been trying to figure out what Trey Gowdy's trying to do, because there's an article in CNS News in which he talks about trying to get at her email server.
Right, right.
And Gowdy, basically the headline says, Gowdy, our committee doesn't have the power to seize Hillary's email server.
Okay.
Now, there's some important things in this article that I found interesting. This came out, he was interviewed on Morning Joe, Joe Scarborough, sure. And Micah Brzezinski there on MSNBC. For all the you MSNBC mavens, all four of you in the audience.
Oh, MSCCCP?
Yeah. Okay, yes. MSCCCP. Basically, what he said, he was asked about it. He said, quote, well, our committee doesn't have the power under our rules. We don't have the power to seize a personal property like that. That's the email server.
Right.
The House as a whole, that's frankly an open constitutional question as to whether the House as a whole has that legal authority. But frankly, we shouldn't have to compel it.
If it's a private email server. Now, that leads us back to
exactly.
The other little point about where this server is housed.
Yes, exactly. And we should segue into that before I go back to the quote. Because
sure.
It was recently discovered, an IT expert traced it. It's housed in a Manhattan
federal
government building.
Okay, folks, I don't think Hillary Clinton owns a federal government building as her private.
She may think that she owns it.
She may think so.
She may think that if she gets elected president, she'll own it, but she doesn't own it. So that server, I'm assuming somebody knew that was going to be done and said, you better set it up under government in a government office so you can have access to the secured communication lines. That's the only explanation, which means that somebody knew that if a dark server was going to be set up and put it in a place where there's ample security. Okay. Now, to go on with Gowdy, you can subpoena, but the power to subpoena is only as good as the power to compel compliance, Gowdy, an attorney, said. But rather than have that protracted legal battle, I don't know why she doesn't just turn the server over. I found that very interesting. So basically, here's what we find out from this. If Gowdy isn't being disingenuous, and I think he is.
Okay.
He's saying, we can issue a subpoena, but you don't have to comply.
Yeah.
So next time you get a congressional subpoena, you can say, I'm not coming.
Right. Can't,
do you think that's true?
No.
No, Barry. No. What happens to people who refuse to testify under oath in a congressional hearing or supply the documents?
They get a brand new, beautiful, shiny pair of bracelets that they get to wear along with a new outfit that's orange. Oh. And they get a set and look in their new abode, which is a very vertical look.
The Gray Bar Hotel.
Gray Bar Hotel. Yeah,
they get a new ID, it
starts
with prisoner number.
PN
227. No, contempt of Congress. They will throw you in a federal brig for contempt of Congress. Now, what game is Gowdy playing here?
Mm-hmm.
He's basically saying he already knows what the contents of some of this stuff is. I think he's telegraphing that he already knows what some of this stuff is.
He's got a good handle on what they're going to find.
And he's saying, okay, let's play this out. Let's see where the political bodies are buried.
Mm-hmm.
What he wants to do is, okay, Hillary, he can see that she's already squirming under the scrutiny of the press. When you got guys on MSNBC like Lawrence O'Donnell, who are tossing her head first under the bus, and he is.
Yes, they are.
She's basically toast.
Right.
Regarding a presidential run.
You know what? I have to feel for Trey Gowdy, though, because he's got an awful lot in front of him. Because, first of all, you're going to have to figure out what aliases she used in order to be sure that you've traced all
right.
The emails. And then you have to make sure that they weren't, duplicating, because in another story from Breitbart, It says Clinton Holder Jackson. Am I sensing a pattern? Because not only did Hillary have a quote unquote private email server that she was doing things on that she shouldn't have been doing as an elected public official, so was Eric Holder. He was using emails. He was sending emails under several aliases as his in his role as Attorney General. And also Lisa Jackson used a nom de plume of Richard Windsor to email under. And now their big problem is that these things said that the practice has been widespread of having multiple email accounts, but historically they've been under the person's name and not as their official capacity. These are all under aliases and false names, which leads you to believe that maybe there was something they didn't want the public to know about their conduct, their personal conduct, or their conduct in office. Holder used names like Henry Yearwood and others. but supposedly that was to guard against security risks. Woohoo! Did I mention earlier about the Democrats needing to get more comfortable with technology? Because they seem to have a little problem.
Yes,
with it
exactly.
They seem to don't understand that, you know, technology is a tool, but if you use it to try to swing at somebody's head, oftentimes you'll hurt yourself.
Well, you know, I use a fake name usually when telemarketers call. but that's about the only time I use a fake name. I do occasionally, they'll ask me who I am, and I'll say my name is Bob Loblaw.
Blah, blah, blah.
Bob Loblaw. How do you spell that? B-O-B-L-A-B-L-A-W. Bob Loblaw. So, you know, and I'll occasionally send a package as a joke to somebody with the two Bob Loblaw. So,
but I like that. I think I'm going to remember that one.
I stole it. So if I only could get points for being that clever.
But just remember, though, the Obama administration is the most transparent administration in history.
Okay,
and Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder and Lisa Jackson and Lois Lerner are just following a long line of tradition.
Look, here. Judicial Watch is tracking how long it takes for them to fulfill an FOIA request. Right. I believe the number I saw was 452 days.
Right, which is over a year, which is ridiculous. Well, that's probably part of the reason, Chuck, why just recently a survey, a national survey by the University of Chicago, in their independent research organization, found in their 2014 General Social Survey that only 11% of the American public have confidence in the executive branch, and only 5% have confidence in Congress. And really, it's a situation where, you know, the 11% is a record low. Last time it got down into that low of double digits was in 1996. Oh, wait a minute. That was during Bill Clinton's administration when Hillary Clinton was the first lady. And you had Whitewatergate and Parkgate. And, you name the gates.
Well, we had the whole mess with the impeachment.
The impeachment and the blue dress and Monica Lewinsky. Yeah. But, you know, but those were all
perjury under oath. Yeah. Just so everybody remembers, no, it wasn't about sex. The impeachment was about perjury under oath.
Right. And I'll tell you what, having worked in politics as long as I have, and especially on campaigns, you always look at your favorable, non-favorable numbers to determine whether or not your candidate really has a chance. Well, Barack Obama better thank his whatever God he prays to that he doesn't have to run for election again, because right now he has 11% confidence in the presidency versus 44% that say they don't have any confidence at all in the presidency.
0%.
That's a 4-to-1 negative margin.
That's a big one.
That's huge. And really, and it's no surprise that Democrats have more confidence in the executive branch than the Republicans do. Only 3% of Republicans, and I think that's Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, say that they have a lot of confidence in the presidency. The highest point that's been was at 27% back when George Bush was in office in 2002. So
that's pretty bad.
That's a huge drop off.
Yeah, it is.
Now, of course, you know, Democrats really, you know, it takes a lot to shake them, but some of them are getting shaken because in 2010, their confidence level of their president was 25%, high confidence. So high to mid to low, 25%. It's now 18% in 2014. Now, you think about that. Only 7% of Democrats have woken up enough to realize that they've been sold a bill of goods. That's what that says. And just 1 in 10 independents expressed a lot of confidence in the presidency. Now, of course, nobody likes Congress at all. 7% among Democrats have support for Congress, 5% among independents, and 3% among Republicans.
Wow.
Now, of course, that 3% is John Boehner and Mitch McConnell. You know, they have a great deal of confidence in the presidency and in what they're doing.
Exactly.
Now, of course, the survey doesn't name those names. I'm just doing that for fun. just so no one goes out there and is like, well, they didn't say that.
I heard those two guys say that, and that must be the truth. Well, okay, folks, we do kid around here occasionally, yeah. And my name is not Bob Loblaw.
Bob Loblaw. I love that. But anyhow, so, you know, Chuck, and here's another person who ought to understand technology who catches up with them at the local state level. Here in Ohio, we've got a situation where we had some sitting state representatives who were indicted and convicted of ethical offenses, mainly around utilizing money from their campaigns for their personal use. And one who just came up with a request to be early released from prison, Clayton Lucky, who was a former Democrat lawmaker from Dayton, got his request denied by the courts. Judge says, quote, release at this time would demean the seriousness of the offense, unquote. He's serving 3 years at Southeast Correctional for money laundering, election falsification, and theft. Again, technology will catch up with you, Clayton. All of those withdrawals and checks you wrote to yourself out of your campaign, Guess what? It's a record. Just like Hillary Clinton's going to find out, it's a record. Now, he should have been like Congressman, or not Congressman, but Al Sharpton, who is all but a congressman in New York. Al Sharpton, who, when he ran for mayor in 97 and president in 2003, all of a sudden had suspicious fires destroy his financial records. Not once, but twice, Chuck. Each time he ran for an office, All of a sudden he had a fire.
Yeah.
You know what? Guys, take it from Al Sharpton. Burn, baby, burn.
Yeah. Well, of course, it's usually after someone has asked questions about, we want to see your paper trail on your financing.
We want to see your financial records. Yeah, it all happens that way.
Al's another guy who basically is a self-made man. Where'd all his money come from? Oh, well, fleecing the flock.
Well, yeah.
And by the flock, I don't mean that I don't think Reverend Al's had a church for years and years and years and years. Since not too long after the whole Tawana Brawley. And if you don't know who that is, then You need to get some gray hairs, man.
Yeah.
Because Tawana Brawley was a young woman who basically got caught being out all night and partying. And in order to keep her parents from asking questions, she said she was kidnapped by white cops, beaten and raped and had all these horrible things. And somebody carved something in her stomach. Well, she carved it.
She did it herself, and it was all made up as a hoax.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, Chuck? And just kind of in closing, another Democrat who ought to understand technology better than they do is Indiana Democratic State Representative Justin Moed, whose name has hit the media not because he's an up-and-coming star. It's because he's not smart enough to work himself out of a wet paper bag. He was just caught, and he's now apologized publicly and now wants everybody to leave him alone so he can handle his own private family matters.
Yeah.
Sexting, which is sending explicit and sexual texts, and questionable gifts to a young lady by the name of Sydney Leathers. Now, that name might sound familiar to some people because Sydney Leathers was the self-same porn star that former Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner was caught and lost his seat over with his inappropriate technological relationship with this young lady.
Well, it also cost him. It continued to the fallout cost him a New York City mayoral.
mayoral race. That is right. So Justin Moed, who represents downtown Indianapolis, posted all of these graphic sexual things on Twitter using, I can't even use the handle that he used because it's offensive.
You can find the story if you really want to
find the story. It's over on Fox News. You can take a look at it. But, you know, Moed says, "I'm truly sorry. I've hurt the ones I love most with my poor judgment." He's probably talking about himself because if you start reading into the story, you realize that this person has a unique viewpoint of, shall we say, healthy, normal relations between people. So,
well, that being said, guess what? We're out of time for this week. We would ask that you would join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.